Welcome to On Delmarva. I'm your host, Mark Steiner. Every week, you'll find us right here on WEAA as we follow the stories that affect the land and the communities of Delmarva. Join us today as our panel wrestles with the future of development on Delmarva. Is developing farmland into houses a way to make our communities economically viable? Can our towns and cities survive without taking over farmland and more county land? Can counties survive and grow without taking over farms and continuing to build? Is it possible for us to develop in a way that doesn't harm agriculture, provides strong communities for our residents, and avoids harming the environment? Then, don't miss commentator Tom Horton talking about the power of wind, not as an energy source, but as a force that affects all of us on Delmarva in ways we might not even notice. First, let's get you home safe and turn this over to WEAA Traffic. And then we'll be right back with our panel about development. I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome to On Delmarva. Today, we're going to talk about growth, our communities, EPA, houses, people. What's the future of the Eastern Shore with some of our guests here? We're broadcasting today from Public Radio Delmarva in Salisbury, Maryland, and we have been joined by Mayor Russ Brinsfield from Vienna, I was going to put you in Virginia, Vienna, Maryland. Vienna, Maryland, who is here in the studio with us, and also professor at the Maryland Ag School in Y, and a farmer of 150 acres. Virgil Shockley is with us. He's a Worcester County commissioner and a farmer and a bus driver. And we got to get him out of this building so we can take care of his kids and get him home safe. So, gentlemen, welcome. Good to have you in the studio.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, this is I was reading a lot on the way down here, not while I was driving. My producer was driving so I could read. And
that's good.
That's good. It's a good thing. And
you didn't have your cell phone on. Then,
right. Instead of looking at the road. But one of the things that I was reading by some things that Tom Horton had written. When he wrote that piece on growth.
Mm-hmm.
And he was suggesting in a very broad sense that the question is not smart growth or sustainable growth, but we have to think perhaps about stopping growth as we know it and thinking about a different way to develop and build our economy and build our communities, because growth is going to just overwhelm us and the generations after us.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about that broad notion?
Yeah, well, I think
Russ Brinsfield.
So long we have not been paying the actual price for utilizing our natural resource base. So I do think Tom is correct. Over the long haul, we've got to talk about things like carrying capacity, quality of life, how we can protect the environment. And I'm convinced that somewhere out in the future, we're going to have a serious discussion about whether or not we ought to be growing at all. That somewhere in the scheme of things, you have to just say, to protect the natural resource base, to have any kind of quality of life, that's it.
Virgil?
It's ironic, I guess, what you just said about the number of people coming here. In 2008, the county commissioners, Worcester County, finished their comprehensive plan.
You're a commissioner.
I'm a commissioner, and I actually voted against it. I was the only vote against the comprehensive plan in Worcester County because it took in farmland that was next to towns and basically designated it residential. So you went from an A1 zone where you were allowed in Worcester County 5 lots to an automatic designation of R. Residential, R1, and just under the assumption that you're going to have X number of people coming here. And I love that assumption word, because what you had is now you have a case where you are allowing your zoning to be judged by perhaps if you build it, somebody will come, instead of looking at it, let's build it when they get here and we have jobs for them and a place for them to work and a community that will support them. And I think the mayor's correct here. For too long, we're kind of looking at it from one angle of saying, okay, they're coming, we have to build it, instead of saying, how many do we really want? and a quality of life goes a long way.
Just let me give you an example from a report done by the Eastern Shore Land Conservancy.
Mm-hmm.
They're talking about over the next 25 to 30 years, well, 20 years now, about 160,000 new residents coming to the Eastern Shore of Maryland, resulting in about 70,000 new houses. And the really alarming factor is under current zoning and growth scenarios, consuming about 215,000 acres of farm and forest.
215,000 more acres.
Yep.
215,000. Now, just to put that in context, that would represent all of the ag land base in probably two to three counties mm-hmm. on the lower shore. So if you can think like Worcester County and Wicomico yep. County and maybe Somerset County, by the year 2030, the equivalent of all of that ag land will be gone to unsustainable consumptive use of land to accommodate growth.
So what do you do about that? I mean, how do you – you're both elected officials,
mm-hmm.
And both the counties that you come from, have, if I'm correct, mm-hmm. have really different views about – and zoning ideas. Is that right? Is that fair to say?
Well, in Worcester County, we have – we've probably protected our farmland more than any other county in the state. If you look at what is actually allowed – on a farmland, it goes back to the zoning that was in place in 1978, and you can divide, let's say you had 100 acres, you can divide that parcel four times, the original zoning, the original parcel, plus four more times, okay? You can have five residences, okay, if you had one on the original one, so you end up with five lots. So by doing that, we have protected farmland because we don't, We would rather designate it, and there's both sides to this coin. You would rather designate an area where you have water and sewer already available, okay, so you're not going out and chewing up farmland, and also you're putting in septics at the same time, okay? And you got to realize the sewer is the sewer. If you look at farmland, what do you have around it? Ditches. So
ditch is a whole other question.
Ditch is a whole other question you're going to bring up. But you know, farmland is farmland. Number one, they're not making any more of it. Number two, nobody's clearing forestry land around here to get to farmland. That's become illegal, actually, now since 1980-something. So when you start planting houses where you planted corn and soybeans, I sat next to Jim Perdue, and he said, you know, the biggest concern you would think, you know, with the federal regulations and everything else, I hate paraphrasing here, but he said the biggest concern to him was the lack of farmland that would be left once the building boom continued, if the building boom continued on, because you have to have corn and soybeans, and they have to be shipped in here from the Midwest. We do not grow enough here on the shore to keep the poultry, to feed the poultry that we have here. So everything has to be, not everything, what is the equivalent of what we grow here and what they need in order for the rest of the year has to be brought in by rail.
Mayor?
Well, yeah, I don't disagree. I thinking about this driving over and with my mayor's hat on,
mm-hmm.
one of the things I think we need to do is think more seriously about redeveloping the cores of our existing communities. Just in the town of Vienna, for example, there's probably, we're a small community, there's probably 10 to 15 vacant lots or lots that have dilapidated houses on them that are not inhabited.
Within town limits.
Within the town limits. I use that as an example. The numbers are small, but you've got the same sort of thing probably with every community. The problem when I talk to developers is the incentives for them, in other words, if they cost out what it would take them to build a house in the countryside versus building a house in the town of Vienna on a vacant lot, it's actually cheaper for them to build outside of town. Now, here's where we get to the issue. I would argue that we're not on that house that's developed on an acre or 2 acre land outside of the town of Vienna. The true cost, long-term cost associated with putting that house out there is not in the equation. The added cost for police protection, for emergency service, for clearing roads, for transportation for children. If somehow that costs got integrated into the cost of building that house there, then we'd have a more of a level playing field to where developers would be just as well off or better off to develop in the town where there's existing infrastructure. So, number one, we need to figure out how to get that done. I'm not sure how it's done. It's got to be done through incentives and disincentives, I think. The other thing that we need to do is we really need to think about providing ways to have designated growth areas around existing communities from which the developer gets more density if he buys development rights from farmers that own land in the areas that we want to keep rural. Either transfer development rights, purchase of development rights, scenarios to where you give the developer, for example, if we annex a farm in Vienna now, its current density is 1 in 20.
Vienna has annexation rights.
Yeah, we have annexation rights, so we can annex something in the town. What I say is in order to – and that the zoning on it may be 1 in 20 or 1 in 15, whatever the case may be. I would argue that what we need to do in order to get the density that we want, the average of 3.5 units per acre, which is the state recommendation, that developer – in order to get that density, would have to buy development rights from the farmers in the areas that are designated that we want to keep rural.
You're talking about almost like cap and trade?
Sort of a cap and trade. And this way, farmers don't lose their equity in their land value vis-a-vis downzoning. But in order to get the developer the density he needs to make it work, then he has to buy those development rights from the farmer. That's things like that, I think, is what we've got to think about in the future.
Let me put a plug in here because I don't want to be coming across as someone who is not looking at the farming side of it. As part of my argument when we were doing the comp plan was
the comp plan is
the comprehensive plan for Worcester County.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and every county has to do one. Every town has to do one by you know every I think it's what 8-10 years whatever it is in the state of Maryland. So everybody has one. Okay, so in the comp plan when we were doing the comp plan, I made the argument that look. If you want to say farmland, you need to say farmers. I mean, if you look at the average age of the farmers that are out here, okay, I'm 57 years old. I'm a kid. I mean, you got people running 70, 72, 74 years old. You look at you look at the average age. If you're not in a family that is farming, number one, it's almost impossible to get in farming, okay? So I made the argument that, look, we need to somehow get away from those five lots, which is guaranteed in the code, Worcester County Code. You're guaranteed those five building lots on a parcel, all right? We need to allow two more, but for immediate family members only. Because what you've got
to be able to build a house on your land for like
the grandkids,
children, right?
The grandkids. Because what you got, people are living longer. You have the grandfather, had three kids, 1, 2, 3. Okay, those three kids got married. All three of them live on the farm. Now you have four houses that are there already, and you only allow five. So which one of your grandkids are you going to say can live here, and which ones have to move away? And my idea basically was that if you allow this two extra parcels,
yeah,
okay, then you have an incentive for those grandkids to stay on the farm. Because if they're not on that farm and they don't get the taste, and they've lived there all their life, okay, and sometimes people need to move away in order to come back to appreciate what they had.
Well, can you
lost that argument, by the way, but anyway.
You lost the argument.
I lost that argument. No, it's not part of our comp plan.
And why do you think you lost the argument?
Because people were afraid to open it up. But if you cap it, and I actually threw the incentive in. I said, look, make it if somebody uses this, they don't stay for 10 years, then fine, take 5% of the penalty.
It seems to me that if we go back to looking at the real cost, get back to this rural sort of sprawl that we're experiencing. I would argue, just like Virgil, if you've got one house on 100 acres versus 10 houses on 100 acres, do the math. In the long term, the net return to the county on the tax base is going to be negative. For every dollar, just like Virgil said, for every dollar comes in, it costs you $1.50 going out. Let me tell you how this is really been driven home more recently, and Virgil, you're on the county council, so you're aware of this as well, is the 90% reduction in the highway user revenue. Let me talk to you a little bit about how this works. What happens is, in a way, municipalities and counties get rewarded for additional miles of roads that you have in your county, because you get a some way it's adjusted to where for every mile of road you have, you get a revenue stream based on the gasoline tax comes back to the municipalities and the counties to maintain those roads and that infrastructure. What happened as a result of the budget crisis this past year, we were cut to 10% of that fund. So for a little town like Vienna, we would get $35,000 to $40,000, and just round the math also, this last year we got $3,000 to $4,000.
That's a huge cut.
Huge cut.
It's a small town.
But we still, you got to patch the holes. You got to clear the streets from snow. You got to have the streetlights on for safety. So my point is, this is indicative of an unsustainable growth pattern. Because what's happening is you're having to supply all those services for Dorchester County, or in the case of Somerset County, you're still having to apply all those services. But the people that are located in those rural areas that are demanding those services, the revenue is being generated from those folks via taxes is not equal to the amount that it takes to provide those services. So if we continue to have this huge reduction in highway user revenue, I think this is going to cause counties and municipalities to reevaluate how they grow, because they're not going to be able to depend on the state for a revenue stream to come back to help them maintain those.
But what about situations like what happened in Berlin, Maryland, is Waller Landing, and the kind of power of a developer to say, we're going to build and win, despite what most of the county wanted, what the state wanted, even most of the citizens wanted. I mean, isn't that something you face as well, whether as a commissioner or as a mayor, when you talk about development?
Well, okay, in the case you're talking about something that was zoned, let's say, in 95. See, once you get the change, remember, if you go back a few minutes, you remember what I said? They changed it from A1 to R1 in the comp plan, okay?
That you voted against.
That I voted against,
right.
Okay, all right. But I wasn't sitting there in 95 when they did the comp plan. So in the comprehensive plan back in 1994, 1995, what you had is a designation for this area for growth. Doesn't matter, it was A1 at the time. All right? They designated it R1. Once that zoning's in place, and nobody wants it, because people spend money, they buy the land with the zoning. And the argument is, you can't downzone me because I bought this property with expectations. All right? So in the case you're talking about, that zoning was there. The project comes along 10 years later. And people go, well, why are you allowing this to happen? Your hands are tied. Unless you're willing to collect enough votes and basically risk a total lawsuit. And you got to realize, these people, I mean, our county budget's $162 million. You got people that $162 million is nothing. I mean, absolutely nothing. I mean, they'll tie you up in court for 5 years if you want to go this route. So, you, number one, you couldn't collect the votes to say, no, we're going to put this back to whatever it was before 1995 A1. Number two, the person bought it with the expectations. So you get into property rights issue, okay? But that's what you had. A lot of this was zoned a certain way years and years and years ago. And unless you're willing to go back and literally fight an uphill battle, and you bring everybody into it, because everybody goes, oh, I'm going to lose. And you're right. If you go down zoning a lot of land, then, you know, there are people who are going to lose value in that. Let me go back to the tax thing on the gasoline tax just a second. You think you had it bad? In FY 2008, which is the 2007 year, FY 2008, Worcester County got $5.2 million. FY 11, we got $99,000 for gasoline road tax.
So... I'd like to hear you talk about Waller's Landing from your perspective as well.
Well, I'm not really familiar with it. So,
okay.
But what I can say is that we need to be more proactive on our comprehensive plans We need to make sure that we require municipalities and counties to follow their comp plans. But the more basic question is, landowners, and I'm a farmer myself, we sometimes want it both ways. I mean, we don't want to be downzoned because we want to protect our property values. But on the other hand, sprawl development has a negative impact on all of us. So how the question I have is, how do you ensure the equity to the farmer and at the same time, either through downzoning and you get some sort of compensation or through some purchase of development rate approach? I think that's what has to happen.
You're listening to On Delmarva on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And we'll be right back.
I'm Mark Steiner. We're here at Delmarva Public Radio. This is On Delmarva. You're listening to right now. We've been talking with Mayor Russ Brinsfield, Vienna, Maryland, who you just heard. Also, Virgil Shockley, Worcester County Commissioner. Both those men are also farmers. And Mayor Russ Brinsfield is also on the faculty, University of Maryland School of Agriculture here at Y. And Virgil Shockley, we have another 25 minutes or so with him because he's got to go get that bus and take those kids home safely. And we've just been joined by King Burnett, who's a partner at the law firm of Webb Burnett, Jackson, Cornbrooks, Wilbur, Voorhis, and Douse, and a board member of the Aztec Coastal Trust. And King, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. So in talking about what happened at Waller Landing, but that could be repeated dozens of times across Delmarva, all three states, all across the shore. And we talked about the Calvert County example a little bit. So the question is, this could sound dull and boring to some people, but it's actually, not this conversation does, but I'm saying, but the idea of talking about planning and zoning, but when you're talking about the future of a community and when you're talking about the future of the land and the water and the people who live on it now, it's anything but boring because it has to do with your kids and grandkids and the great-grandkids you might never see. Mm-hmm. What happens to your land and your land?
That's right.
Right?
That's correct.
So what do we do? How do you get to a point, given the political well, let me just put it out on the table. Maybe you all disagree with this. Given the political power of developers in, I always liken sometimes some of my best friends are developers. They're nice people, but in many ways, developers are like on Capitol Hill. The lobbying industry, they have lots of power because they come with money and they own property. So what do you do in terms of how you control what you want to see for the future of your children and the reality of the economic political power that wants to build houses on the land that you farm corn, soy, or vegetables, whatever you're farming on it?
Okay.
King, you just got here, so let me throw it to you first.
Yeah, well, you know, when you first have to create a vision of what it is you want your community to be like. And it, you know, the vision thing, as they say, and it is important. It is important. And, you know, one of the things that we're leaving behind in all of this is our towns, you know, the quality of life in our towns. We have to have a good quality of life in our towns. For example, the town of Berlin, down Virgil's Way, you know, has decided it, you know, wants to establish itself as a, you know, vibrant place. And it's done that. It's done that successfully. Russ Brinsfield's Vienna, when they did their plan, and you know, to establish Vienna as a place that not where you build around it, or Berlin, a town that you build around it. You know, we want to abandon so many of our towns and build around them. That's what the developers sometimes think is easier. And I think we have to create a vision and a way to get to make our towns vibrant, great places to live, and ones where we can put our development. So that's an aspect that I think is at the core of the problem. It's not just, well, we can't, we're going to prohibit them from going somewhere else. We've got to have some place for them to go. So I think this is where we're the starting point.
Mayor Brinsfield.
Yeah, no, I was thinking to follow up with King. One of the ways that we were able to get significant change in our zoning in the town of Vienna in the concept of creating a vision plan was we actually had a community meeting and it was co-sponsored with the Conservation Fund to sort of look at creating a vision for Vienna by the year 2020. And one of the options was look at sort of the default position. And what I mean by that is you take your current comp plan, your current zoning, and you look at what build-out would look like if you just didn't do anything. And I must say that that was the most – that we had a watershed event happen when we put that on scale on a map of saying, folks, if we do nothing, this is what our town's going to look like the year 2020. And it literally scared the bejeebies out of everyone. So it kind of gets back to King's idea. You know, we have this sort of, you know, mindset about what we want the landscape to look like. But when we ride out in the landscape, we assume it's always going to be the way it is we see it now. And we don't realize what is underlying the zoning on that property to where it really what it really could look like. So I agree with King. Creating a vision. And in that concept, in that construct, look at what it is that's going to happen to your town if you leave business as usual. And that provided the impetus and the initiative for the town of Vienna to go the next step and create a vision plan, look at limiting development, look at to make sure the density was of the area to be developed was equal to the density in the town now. And then saying after that, we don't want any more growth, so we've actually created a green belt around our community to where there will be no more growth. Once we do build out of what it is we have now. Now, that's the way a local town has decided to do that. And I think what King is saying, and I think Berlin has done that in a way, and in some ways
in Worcester County, in Worcester County, in your county.
Yeah, right. And Berlin, in my view, is one of the model towns that always look like for Vienna to aspire to be like. You got good business, good leadership. They've revitalized their core. When you ride through town, you don't see a lot of vacant lots. You don't see a lot of dilapidated houses, so a sense of pride there. So that community spirit exists there, and that's what I think we're trying to build in Vienna. And like I say, I always use Berlin as the model from which we'd like to see Vienna sort of become.
Virgil?
And I thank both of you for pointing out that Berlin is a great town, and they have done a fantastic job. It's one of the few towns where you can actually see businesses. The businesses have increased in the economic downturn. They actually have more businesses now than they did. You know, so if you look at what they have done, then you know it should be duplicated. But let me tell you a little story about political will. Mm-hmm. We were doing the comp plan in 2008. And 589, as you know, is where the racetrack is. Okay. And there are seven members of my commission. And when the zoning came up for 589, because we were taking section by section by section, four of us basically made the argument, we want to see the plan that the state of Maryland has in mind for what 589 is going to look like, because we're going to dualize it until we decide what's going to get zoned, what's going to get rezoned, upzoned, if you will. You would have thought we'd kick somebody in the head because people came out screaming and yelling, and I never heard the like, because now you've got the other side of the coin. You have people who have land there that they have been setting there waiting, and they've been waiting for this comp plan, because only under a comprehensive rezoning can you get and change the scope of things by, in our case, four votes, all right? So you don't have
how many
to have,
how many are you? Are you
seven? There's seven of us. So right. Four votes can change the zoning. You don't have to go through a text amendment. You don't have to go through an appeal. You don't have to do anything. Under a comp plan, four votes change the zoning. So four of us basically made the argument that until the state of Maryland shows us a plan of what the dualization of 589, it's only 4.8 miles, by the way.
This is where the lottery parlor was?
This is where right. The racetrack is. This right. is where it's going to become. And this is why we did it. We wanted to see what the state was going to put in. And we didn't want just six lanes of highway. You know, they wanted something nice. They didn't want it looking – nobody from Glen Burnie, I hope. But they didn't want it looking like another Glen Burnie, okay? So they wanted something nice down there, and they wanted to be able to have people walking across and not get run over and from one side to the other. And we caught a lot of heat, and I do mean a lot of heat, for taking that stance and saying – and we dug our heels in and said, no, when the state of Maryland you know, Department of Transportation comes up with a plan and shows us what that road's going to look like, we will revisit this. And that's the only thing that we did not, we didn't change anything on 589 at all. We just said, when you show us a plan, we'll go back and we'll evaluate it. But that took the political will to stand up and say no. And a lot of time, it's political will. And you're not popular. You don't become popular by doing that.
I mean, is it just pie in the sky dreaming to think that you can grow your communities, our communities, inside of the towns or close to it, and not spread them to farmers, and farmers to survive without having to go into subdivisions and sell their places so they can retire and move to Florida, whatever. But I mean, so is there a way to do that, or is just this unrealistic conversation?
I think it's realistic. I mean, if you look at the examples of all the towns on the shore that are doing this, some of which we've already talked about, and you know, if we don't want to become a Glen Burnie, and listen, we have a big problem with that over here in the Wicomico County with Salisbury and you know, Fruitland and Delmar, our urban core, those three municipalities, we are dependent here on whether we can make something of these communities that's better than what we have, whether we can improve these communities. And our comp plan for the county has got to recognize that, in my judgment. That's sort of a starting place. Instead of just saying, well, they have their plan, you know, we're just supposed to plan for the rest of the county. I think we have to recognize that this urban core is vital to everybody. You know, we drive around Salisbury, and when you drive over the town line into Fruitland or into the county, you know, we don't pay attention to these to that. We just think of it, you know, we have to think of ourselves as a whole community. Revitalization is possible. We see it. We've done it with historic districts in Salisbury. That's been a big help to neighborhoods. We have neighborhood associations of people working to better their community. We have community watch, you know. We have to do something about crime in our community. So these are things that we are working on in this community. And I think that's going to be the clue to our success. Instead of everybody saying, well, I just don't want to live in there. You know, I want my house out there. All we're going to do then is abandon, you know, our towns and let them go down, just be rental properties, yeah, and ruin what we have all come here or stayed here to be a part of.
Let me take the other side of that, I guess. Let me make this statement. As mm-hmm. long as farming is profitable, farmers won't sell their farmland. Okay? You'll get a little bit of sell-off, and if nobody wants to continue or if there's an illness or there's basically no way out. But if you were born and raised there, it's literally a part of you. Okay? And if your kids stay, this goes back to the point I was trying to make. If your kids grew up on that farm, believe me, I have two sons right now, and a daughter for that matter, does not want to live anywhere else. And she has traveled probably more than a lot of the, she's 25 years old, and she's been in many different states. Okay? She's in Florida currently right now, but she's coming back, and this is her home. And sometimes you got to go away to appreciate what you do. So, as long as farming is profitable, it won't matter. But you're getting into a area where you're looking at farming, and whether you like it or not, poultry is king on the shore. Okay? And you can't say farming without bringing up Purdue, Tyson, Mount Air, Allens. You can't do that. All right? And to think that you can take one away from the other, take the chicken industry away from the corn and soybean and wheat and the barley, it's not going to happen. And I think some people miss that connect. Oh, we're not hurting farming, but when you go after Tyson, the Purdue's and everything, and you beat them down to a point where the state of Maryland, okay, has regulations in place that are more restrict than the state of North Carolina, it always comes down to being a business. I'm a businessman. You're a businessman. At the end of the day, I make money farming, or I make a decision not to be in farming, okay? And they are a business.
Well, you raise an issue that I wasn't going to get into today, but I mean, that I would look forward to in the conversation, but which is the idea of the future of farming on the shore, and what that future is. And the argument some people have that you can transform agriculture to be a different thing, like they did in the Central Valley of California. People argue it could happen here. Other people argue, no, it couldn't happen here. I think that's a discussion that needs to happen, I would argue. No matter what your point of view
Virgil,
is, I think
Virgil's
that's discussion.
Right.
But Virgil, I think you have a strong point.
I agree with him. And I think, you know, we have to recognize that our interest in having communities that we want to live in is dependent upon having a farming community, because we're not going to have what we think of as the Eastern Shore without farms and farmers. And they have to make a living, and it has to be successful. And I have always felt that there is a very common interest between the business interests, the farming interests, and the environmental interests as a core concept for the shore. And this is what, you know, there's a real coalition of interests. In this community, for example, we've had the Greater Salisbury Committee and the Chamber of Commerce and the environmental groups all being in favor of good planning and a vision for our community that they all agree on. And that's the only way we're going to proceed. And there are going to be little blips along the way between all of these interests, but at core we have a common interest here.
Yeah, the poultry industry is critical, but I would differ with you a bit. I think the biggest threat to the poultry industry not staying on the shore has more to do with the loss of farmland to sprawl development than it has regulation. A lot of that regulation you're talking about is going to be national in scope. So to the extent that it has any kind of negative economic impact, it's not going to be to the advantage of the poultry industry to locate somewhere else over the long haul. So the conversations I have, I think the sprawl development and loss of 215,000 acres of farmland over the next 20 years to sprawl development is a big, much bigger threat to the long-term survivability of the poultry industry and grain farming on the shore than regulation. Now, I may be wrong on that, and I'm sure I'll hear it, but there has to be the balance. But that's equivalent of losing all the farmland, as I said earlier, in 3 to 4 counties. Is the remaining, I believe there is a critical mass of land that's needed to sustain agriculture as we know it on the shore now, and to keep the poultry industry, the leadership in the poultry industry on the shore. So wouldn't you have to argue that threat of sprawl development and zoning is also tied to the long-term survivability of the farming and the poultry industry?
I guess I would make the argument that of the two right now, I think that if you look at the state of Maryland versus what you have, this is Region 3 EPA. If you look at Region 4 North Carolina, they have been building or are continuing to build new poultry houses down there. And this is just my opinion, okay, on this whole matter, and I don't want somebody to walk away and say this is somebody else's opinion, but in my opinion, the reason that the poultry industry is still here, it's very simple. If you draw a circle from Salisbury, Maryland, or from anywhere here on the shore, let's say, and 12 hours away by truck, that's considered fresh. Yeah. 25% of the population in the United States is what you're hitting. Okay, now, if you go down to North Carolina and you redraw that circle, guess what? You've just narrowed that down to 15% of the population of the United States. But if you look at the number of plants, processing plants, that are still in the state of Maryland, you have the one in Salisbury and one in Cordova. That's it.
Right.
You've got two plants. Everything else is either in Delaware or in Virginia.
When you take what you just said and what you all were saying, King Burnett, Mayor Russ Brinsfield, and Virgil Shockley, and you look at those 215,000 acres of farmland that could go be lost on the Eastern Shore. I'm curious what you think is the political process, the economic process, that saves that 215,000 acres, that doesn't allow it, if that's what you're saying, doesn't allow it to be built. What do you do as leaders? I mean, but you two, you all three are leaders of these communities, and you two are elected leaders. What do you do?
Well, you have a comprehensive plan. And it basically, in Worcester County, we allowed about 3,000 acres of farmland to be switched over from A1 to R1. Okay. And that's our plan. That plan will stay in place for another, let's say it's to about 2016. All right, at 2015, 2016, we will reevaluate. And when you reevaluate, the first thing you're going to find, of course, is that the number of people you thought were coming didn't come. Okay? We allowed enough for a population growth of about 18,000 people. Yet, when we get the census this year, my bet is, and I don't know this for a fact, my bet is we won't have 1,000 people more, 2,000 people at tops from what we had in 2000, the year 2000. So from 1990 to 2000, we grew by about 20%. From 2000 to 2010, we grew by less than 10%. So if you take that factor and factor it on out, you don't need the amount of land that we already have under our comp plans. You can actually stop or at least kind of tweet where your comp plans are. The other thing is, if you don't have jobs for people, that's the key. If you don't have the jobs for people, you're not going to get the growth anyway.
Well, I tend to disagree with that. I mean, if we look in Vienna, if we look at over the last decade, who's bought the homes in Vienna? These are people who are looking for a weekend home, transitioning to retirement, and plan to sell their home on the Western Shore and move to Vienna and live there permanently. So I would say the last 10 homes been sold in Vienna have gone to that kind of resident, not to someone who's actually coming here looking for a job to on the shore. They're already are securing a job, and they're going to sell their home on the Western Shore and live in Vienna and be retired.
How many people are you talking about in the course of a year, though?
Oh, I don't know, but I'm just saying that's a microcosm of what I think is going on, at least in some communities.
King?
Well, we lack, in this county, I think, enough the degree of cooperation between our municipalities and the county that is probably would be helpful to having achieving the vision we need. And you mentioned Waller Landing and Hebron. I mean, there's a community, unfortunately, that has not concentrated on what it can do for the people who live there now to make it a better community first. You know, the first thing they want to do is to annex, you know, all this land and put a building on it where they in my mind and to the people there, I think they would benefit more from having a concentration on making Hebron a better community and having infill come into the town. There's plenty of space there. And it's partly process. You know, Vienna is, to me, is a great, great model, and Berlin, of involving the public in these towns in you know, what kind of a community do you want? And that's what I think we're lacking somewhat here. The draft comprehensive plan for Wicomico County, you know, it doesn't go far enough. It doesn't have any real vision. It doesn't have any enthusiasm for us as a community. That's important. I think enthusiasm for us as a community is a key component. If this is just a piece of paper, you know, that I have to prepare because the state law says I've got to prepare it, you know, it's not going to be anything.
Well, before we have to end this, and because is the two quick ideas we can get to them. I mean, is the you represent a county, a county commissioner, you represent a city, a town. Of Vienna, Maryland, and what you were just saying, King Burnett, is that interest, political interest and divide that deep between what a county might want for its survival and what a town sees that makes this too difficult to overcome?
Let me say from my chair as a commissioner, okay, we look at the whole. Okay, we are responsible for police force, schools, emergency, fire, That side of it. We also, in Worcester County, run the sewer plants. Okay, all the sewer plants, with the exception of the ones that are in the towns, are run by the county. All right. So from a county perspective, we look at as when we look at our budget, we fund about 75% of the school board's budget. We're the highest percentage-wise. We fund the highest amount of any county in the state to the school board. All right. So when you're talking about growth, you're going to sell 20 homes. You might as well figure out of those 20 homes, you're going to get 30 kids. Okay. That's two teachers I just hired. That is potential for a school bus I just hired. That is potential for this and this. So when you're looking at that from a county perspective, I'm sitting there, I'm adding money up that, okay, I need to do this, I need to do that, versus X number of dollars that you're going to get in tax revenue coming in. Now, a town would look at it somewhat differently, however.
Yeah, that's true. We do look at it differently, but I think your point's well taken. I actually think there needs to be more cooperation between counties and towns. I think one of the reasons that we don't have counties more interested in reducing sprawl development is because they don't think about the long-term economic consequences that happens from sprawl development. The issues that we talked about before. I also think towns, in my view, including Vienna, and my friend who's a lobbyist for the Maryland Municipal League will shoot me on this, but I actually think municipalities have too much authority without enough checks and balances on their ability to annex and grow. I think, and then on the other hand, I think counties need to look at a change in the mindset about the values of protecting rural landscapes and their desire to have growth and make sure that growth occurs around existing communities and not out into hinterlands. But I do think that there's got to be more cooperation. And then I really believe at the state level, there has to be consequences as well. I think if you sprawl develop out in the hinterlands and you get pressure from that community to widen a road or provide a service or whatever, I think the state needs to say to the county or the municipality, that's your problem. I told you not to grow out there. It didn't make any sense. So now you're going to have to find the money yourself to deal with those issues. And heretofore, the state has promised to do some of that, but they've not done it. But I think if we're going to talk about real changes in the way we grow, there's going to be more cooperation between towns and counties. There's got to be more carrots and sticks at the state level in terms of funding infrastructure. Or otherwise, I think we're going to continue down what I would say is a totally unsustainable path of growth, which is the default position which we're in now.
I might just add one thing here. We have a new thing that's happened, and that's a recession. Mm-hmm. And we find that government doesn't have enough money, and it costs a lot more money to sprawl to the taxpayer. So we have now a coincidence, I think, of what good planning is generally anyway, what's in the farming interest, what's in the people's interest in terms of culture, you know, and so forth, and what we can afford. We need to build in where we have infrastructure already in place and where we can expand a sewage plant rather than build one. And we don't want our taxes to go up here, we all say. Well, the best way to make that happen is to have a good plan that encourages growth to come into our towns and cities.
I want to thank you all. This has been really a very interesting conversation. I want to thank, we just heard, ASC Coastal Trust Board Member King Burnett, Worcester County Commissioner Virgil Shockley, and Vienna Mayor Russ Brinsfield. Thank you so much for being here. It's been great to have you all on Delmarva, and we'll have you back, I hope.
Sure.
Thank you. We may soon see wind power developed off the coast of Maryland. Today, on Delmarva correspondent Tom Horton reflects not on wind power, but on the power of wind. Wind is a defining force throughout Delmarva, including in many ways you might not ever have thought about. Here's Tom Horton reflecting on some of the many ways wind shapes our landscapes and our lives.
Hello, I'm Tom Horton for On Delmarva, Blowing in the Wind. Among the forces of nature that shape our region, wind is maybe the most unappreciated, the least understood. Chesapeake watermen know wind better than most, know how it dictates where and whether they oyster, how it can make the crabs bury and scatter the fish or fill the nets. Skipjack captains say if you are becalmed, unable to sail your dredges over the oyster grounds, you can buy the wind, buy it for a penny thrown over the side. But if you do, if you're not respectful enough to accept what the Lord gives in his own good time, the story goes, you will reap the whirlwind and lose your vessel. A few decades ago, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers ignored the wind to its sorrow when it built a giant 7-acre concrete model of Chesapeake Bay up on Kent Island to simulate the estuary's tides and currents with hydraulic pumps. The model never worked well, and a big reason was it couldn't reproduce what we now understand is the large and constant influence wind has on tides in the shallow Chesapeake. A strong southerly or an east wind, shoving water up the bay for a few days, can pile several feet of rise onto normal high tides, for example. And a good northwest blow can shove the tides low enough to make big sections of the bay a mudflat. One such wind event in April 1982 made it nearly impossible to move loaded ships in and out of the port of Baltimore. Neither watermen nor biologists understood until recently how the fate of blue crabs from year to year is literally blowing in the wind. Baby crabs briefly need full-strength ocean water to develop. They hatch each summer around the bay's mouth when the tide is ebbing, pushing them out to sea. Prevailing winds usually blow them back into the Chesapeake, but some years they do it better than others. It makes crabbing for a living interesting. The caprice of the wind also helps determine the spawning success of other bay species, from rockfish to menhaden. Bay pollution is wind-driven, too, on scales that last from hours to decades. Because it is so shallow, the Chesapeake is easily set to seiching, a fancy oceanographer word for sloshing, whenever winds bear down harder on one side of the estuary. This can burp deadly low-oxygen waters from the depths, stressing oysters and killing crabs trapped in pots. Conversely, windy summers can promote more mixing between the bay's oxygen-rich surface and the more polluted bottom water, limiting development of so-called dead zones. New research indicates that for a quarter century or more, a long-term climate phenomenon known as the North Atlantic Oscillation may have promoted wind directions on the Chesapeake that favor less mixing and bigger dead zones. Now there are hints that the oscillation might be shifting bay winds back to directions that give us more mixing and a bigger bang for our cleanup efforts. Over on Delmarva's seaside, it was a great and fearsome wind, the August 1933 hurricane that made Ocean City a resort. It cut through the sand barrier that stretched from Fenwick to Chincoteague. The new inlet was stabilized with jetties, opening the village to navigation and a high-rise future. Another historic wind cut just the other way, preserving for the public what is now Assateague National Seashore. The Ash Wednesday nor'easter of March 62 wiped out nearly 6,000 building lots that had been sold on Assateague, leading to federal buyouts that created one of America's premier coastal parks. So that's a little bit about what the wind does, but maybe what it does best is it's just thrilling when it etches a quiet cove at dawn with strokes like fine calligraphy, or blusters its way through the reeds of a marsh and sighs through the tops of pines overhead, or sends great V's of geese and swans scudding before it or ushers in a thunderstorm. Even the Old Testament of the Bible, with all its inspired poetry, usually can find no better way to bring God on stage than the whirlwind or the tempest. Let it blow.
Thank you for joining us for this week's episode of On Delmarva. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. We're engineered by Brian Boone. Our interns are Judith Lloyd, Brian Boone, Richard Good, Gay Pinder, and Marianne Amos. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again and podcast any of our past shows, hear new additional interviews, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for public radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.